Donald Trump in French, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, you'd think it'd be hard for an audience outside the U.S. to understand Donald Trump, but in France, they have National Front leader Marine Le Pen.
Marine Le Pen today and Mr. Trump are talking to the same constituency.
Also, why some activists don't trust the climate negotiators in Paris.
They're traitors to the interests of the people. They've created a massive financial crisis and a massive climate crisis, and for the last 25 years, they haven't given any response.
Plus, a South African student battles subtle racism in class every day.
Things like being in a lecture and not being the hand that gets pointed at. The voices that are allowed to speak and are sort of validated are white male voices.
It's all ahead on The World. For 2 weeks, delegates from nearly 200 nations have been working hard in Paris with the goal of striking a new global climate deal. The future health of our planet may well depend on what they come up with. No pressure. The deadline was today, Friday evening in Paris, and that deadline, well, it's come and gone. Negotiators will now work into the weekend. The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson, is at the Paris Climate Summit. First, Peter, this is not entirely unexpected, right? I mean, these deadlines are often missed at climate summits. Why is that?
Because the task is gargantuan and the process is incredibly complex and almost impossible. 196 or so countries trying to solve maybe the biggest problem the world's ever tried to solve. And they're trying to do it roughly in 2 weeks. I mean, this is a process that goes on, you know, outside of these meetings as well. But coming here in 2 weeks, trying to get every nation in the world to agree on something that's going to affect every piece of their economy, their culture, their relationships with each other, it's virtually an impossible task. And the fact that anything gets done is kind of amazing.
We've been talking about the climate talks for the past 2 weeks, but briefly, remind us what negotiators are trying to accomplish.
Well, it's interesting. There's been a big shift here this week. And, you know, coming in, what they wanted to accomplish was to set in place a bunch of mechanisms that would hold global temperatures to a 2-degree rise above pre-industrial, 2 degrees Celsius rise above pre-industrial global temperature levels. This week, that shifted. That shifted to 1.5, which is what scientists have been telling us really for the last 6-7 years is a much, much safer threshold. So that 1.5-degree goal, no one's sure yet how hard a goal that's going to be, but basically it's dominated the conversation and it's going to be in there as at least an aspirational goal. And yet the mechanisms in the document, such as it is yet, and this is not yet a final document, don't really tell us how to get there. So this morning there was a big panel of 5 major European scientists sort of assessing that goal, which most everybody agrees we should try to meet, at least most scientists agree we should try to meet, and the sort of lack of specificity for how to get there has got scientists saying, you know, everything from this is a really great start, this is giving us the momentum we need to saying that this is close to a disaster and we are not going to make it without really radical changes. One of them, Kevin Anderson of the Tyndall Center in Manchester, England, really kind of pointed the finger right back at us.
If we are serious about a 2-degree C framing and even more so about a 1.5-degree C framing, we need to very seriously think about reducing our energy demand in the short term. There are huge opportunities for us to dramatically reduce energy demand, but it needs to be reduced by people who are high emitters. My guess is by most of us in this room.
Peter, he's clearly pointing fingers, but at this late point in negotiations, what is the remaining sticking point?
Well, there are still many, many sticking points. One is that goal, 1.5, 2, someplace in between. The language is sort of like 2, you know, well under 2 degrees. There is the question of differentiation. Who should do what to cut emissions and who should do what to provide finance to from the wealthier countries to the less developed countries, wealthier countries which got rich on the back of basically the problem we've got now. We caused it. It's going to disproportionately affect much, much poorer countries.
Many negotiators pulled an all-nighter last night. They're going to do that again tonight, probably. They've known the sticking points well in advance. I mean, it's only a 27-page final document. Why can't they just finalize that deal? I mean, they didn't just arrive at this issue 2 weeks ago.
Because the devil is in the details. And this is really when it comes down to countries have to put their cards on the table and say, this is what we stand for. This is where we stand. We can go no farther or we will go to farther than we said we would. And there's still a huge amount of give and take at this very late stage.
The world's environment editor, Peter Thompson, at the Paris Climate Summit. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Carol.
Environmentalists in Paris, of course, share the same sense of urgency to finish a deal in Paris, but many don't share the same confidence in the process itself. Chris Bentley, with our partners at the Ground Truth Project, looked at two types of environmentalists in Paris. First, there's what we'll call little green, the more radical outsiders. Then there's big green, the environmental establishment. Here's Chris.
Shaila Raghav is definitely big green. She's director of climate policy for Conservation International, and this isn't her first rodeo.
I've been coming to these COPs for almost a decade. Bali was my first. That was in 2007.
Not much has gotten done at these conferences since then. But this time around, Raghav says, the atmosphere is remarkably different.
I think there is an inspiring sense of optimism around the COP, I think not only from civil society, but also from government delegates.
But Raghav is inside the conference. Too inside, perhaps, if you're a small green. Someone like Bobby Rigi, a 78-year-old who came here from Seattle to join street demonstrations for climate action. She doesn't expect the negotiations will do much to fix the climate crisis.
I'm a little too cynical about that.
Other activists here are beyond cynical. David Garcia, a 28-year-old from Spain, says he's completely disconnected from the negotiations. People want revolution, he says, not empty promises.
Honestly, I don't try to make my voice heard by the political leaders that are here. They are traitors to the interests of the people. They have created a massive financial crisis, a massive economic crisis, and a massive climate crisis. And for the last 25 years, they haven't given any response.
There's no question that we will not be able to address the challenge of climate change within the current capitalist system. However, what does that mean in practical terms?
Kumi Naidu is from Nigeria, and he sort of straddles the divide between big and small green. He's the executive director of Greenpeace International. Naidu says it's critical that the negotiators strike a deal on climate change in Paris. He hasn't lost faith in the UN process, but he has his reservations. For instance, negotiators are squabbling over how to keep the global average temperature from rising past the critical 2 degrees Celsius threshold by the year 2100. But Greenpeace believes even 2 degrees is too much. And Naidu says rich countries aren't doing enough to help the developing world deal with climate impacts that they had little role in creating.
So for all of those reasons, I think people must be careful that they don't drink the Kool-Aid and get carried away with broad, general statements of urgency that governments are making, because we know that they are playing to constituencies back home.
And even many representatives of Big Green here at the climate talks believe that what happens outside these conference halls, the voices and actions of Little Green, is at least as important as any international agreement. Steve Herz of the Sierra Club, among the biggest of Big Green, says activists play a bigger role than any diplomat.
Look, at the end of the day, the primary driver is going to be citizens holding their own governments to account. So we need people in the streets. We need people voting based on climate change records. We need investigative journalists holding politicians and companies to account. That kind of grassroots pressure, it's absolutely essential.
These talks aren't going to solve climate change by themselves. So, Herz says, curb your enthusiasm, sure, but don't give up hope. For The World, Chris Bentley at the Climate Talks, Paris.
News headlines have been full of ISIS and San Bernardino and Trump lately, and that's pushed some other stories off the radar, like the protests over racial issues at American colleges. Remember? They flared last month at the University of Missouri and spread to other campuses around the country. Sarah Birnbaum is an American reporter living in Cape Town, South Africa, and at first she didn't think people there were paying much attention to campus protests in the U.S.
After all, South Africa has its own student protests to worry about, and there's been next to nothing in the South African press about Mizzou or Yale or Amherst or Princeton. I was wrong. Benamile Zwane is a student at the University of Cape Town, and for more than a year, she's been following the Twitter accounts of two Black Lives Matter activists in the U.S., Duray McKesson and Jonetta Elzey. When they started tweeting about Mizzou, it popped up in Bena's Twitter feed.
And I was like, oh, this is interesting.
Benna says she was struck by the parallels with her own situation.
I was a student participating and experiencing a student movement, and it was very interesting to see another movement, you know, that had some similarities in that it was campus-based, it was talking about an institutional culture of racism, also arise in a completely different part of the world.
Since March, Benna has been protesting the failure of South African universities to, quote, decolonize. She says even though her university has been open to black students since the fall of apartheid in the 90s, the curriculum and the complexion of the faculty have barely changed. South Africa's 80% black, but only 14% of senior faculty throughout the country are black. These days, Benna says it's rare to see overt racism, though it happens.
You get called a slur, or people sing a song that's very derogatory, and you can point to it and say that that's racism.
She says, like in the U.S., the bigger problem on her campus is microaggression, the more subtle slights and jabs.
Things like being in a lecture theater and not being the hand that gets pointed at. The voices that are allowed to speak and are sort of validated are white male voices, and that happens a lot because, you know, our lecturers are predominantly white males.
Benna says the university administration has been urging patience.
I think part of the huge conversation here about race is it's only been, you know, 21 years since 1994 happened, since you have a new democracy where we're not dealing with segregation and people are supposed to be equal, so you can't expect race to go away.
But Benna says the protests at the University of Missouri showed her the flaw in that line of thinking.
So having someone in a context where, you know, the first students of color that were led on to the university were in 1950 still say we experience overt racism on this campus really highlighted why the sort of, it's only 20 years, you really shouldn't be trying to find a non-racial community yet, was so important. It sort of validated the argument that, well, maybe we should start now so it doesn't last for however many more years.
Last week, I sat down with a couple of other UCT student activists in the lobby of their dorm to talk about Princeton University. Students there have been demanding the removal of Woodrow Wilson's name from campus buildings and institutes. President Wilson proposed the League of Nations, but he was also a vocal advocate for segregation and the Ku Klux Klan. Zanele Kabane says it reminds her of what happened here at her university. In April, students toppled a statue of Cecil Rhodes, the 19th century British colonialist and a main architect of segregation in South Africa.
It's very interesting how we can come from different places around the world and have different stories, but being a student at a university, our problems can still be quite similar. There's a kind of a common thread.
Students, specifically black students, are tired everywhere in the world.
This is Nico Nomiani.
We've taken so much from the government, we've taken so much from management, and it has come to this point where we just sort of tied and we want change.
Nico says at least now, university and government officials in both the U.S. and South Africa are finally paying attention. For The World, Sarah Birnbaum, Cape Town, South Africa.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. In Scotland, Donald Trump has become something of a persona non grata. That's despite his major investments in developing golf courses and luxury hotels there. His recent call for a ban on Muslims entering the U.S. has rubbed many Scots the wrong way. Now there's a petition calling for Trump to be banned from entering the U.K. for hate speech. It has more than 400,000 signatures. Nabil Sheikh signed it. He's general secretary of the Glasgow Central Mosque. Nabil Sheikh, what went through your head when you were asked to sign the petition?
Yeah, after listening to the comments made by Donald Trump, the fact that he singled out, you know, a third of the world's population, and he's basically making statements which are pretty much just ludicrous with respect to Muslims, it was the right thing to do.
What's the message you're trying to send?
The message is, no matter who you are, no matter whether you are Donald Trump or you're a member of an extremist group, you're not welcome in the UK if you're going to spread hate. Anybody who has such extreme opinions is not welcome in Scotland or the UK.
You're sort of conveying that Mr. Trump's comments were just as extreme as the Islamic State terror group. It seems a bit of a stretch if you consider that ISIS commits acts of terror. Trump is just expressing his views, isn't he?
Well, that's the viewpoints start off with words, right? So how ISIS are grooming people over the internet. They use the same extreme words over the web to lure people in and to kind of change their mindset onto, you know, an extremist, radicalist viewpoint, that's exactly what Donald Trump is doing, right? So on one point, you know, ISIS are saying, you know, these people, referring to the people in the West, my neighbors and my friends, that they are against them and, you know, they have caused all this. Exactly, that's the same way what Trump's doing. He's pretty much labeling the Muslims as the people to blame for all these extremist activities that are going on. Whereas in reality, the Muslims are at every point condemning ISIS and saying, stop hijacking our name, stop hijacking our religion for your personal gains. So in terms of the extremist comments, no, I stand by what I'm saying.
We've talked to a number of people recently who are Muslim, who are facing scrutiny and discomfort in the wake of the Paris attacks, the San Bernardino massacre, really. Are Muslims in Scotland victims of any of that kind of discrimination?
Yes. Well, I mean, since the Paris attacks, there was a spike in anti-Muslim attacks. You know, Police Scotland recognized that as well, and we held a press conference at the Central Mosque to discuss the issues, saying that at the same time, generally the people of Scotland and Glasgow have come together with the Muslim community. Here in our press conference, we had Catholic and Protestant. We had the president of the Jewish Council of Scotland basically coming out and condemning anybody who attacks the Muslims in Scotland based on what's happened in Paris, and also reaffirming the fact that we, like our Muslim brothers, condone what's happened and we stand shoulder to shoulder with the community.
What would you say to the 10,000 Scots who've apparently signed a rival petition that backs Donald Trump?
Well, I mean, there's always going to be people on both sides of the argument. Certainly, you know, 10,000 people versus, you know, your 400,000 people who don't even want to see them in the UK gives you an idea of the kind of ratios we're talking about. So I don't think we have anything to worry about.
If you had Donald Trump's ear, what would you tell him?
I would say to him, Donald Trump, come and spend a weekend with me as a Scottish Muslim, and let's sit down and talk about why you think what you do. I would love to have that opportunity with him.
Nabil Sheikh is the General Secretary of the Glasgow Central Mosque. Thanks, Nabil.
Thank you very much.
Contrast Trump's rhetoric about Muslims with the scene in Toronto yesterday. 163 refugees from Syria had just landed at the airport there, and they got a warm welcome from Canada's new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, in person. Now, for refugees starting over in a new place, there are challenges ahead. For a few of them, one challenge is going from being well-known back home to an unknown in their new country. Emma Jacobs talks to a former news anchor from Iraq who's now in Philadelphia.
Bajet Abdelwahid has a face familiar to many Iraqis. They'll even recognize him here, half a world away. His wife tells me how a group of his English language classmates once approached him.
One of them, he told him that, I know you, I have seen your face, but where, I don't know. Tell me, please, what's your name?
His wife, Haifa Ibrahim.
They were shouting. They said, we know that we know you. You are here in Philadelphia with us?
People recognize Abdelwahid because he was a news announcer in Iraq for 3 decades on Iraqi state TV and radio. He read the news as bombs fell on Baghdad during the Iran-Iraq war. Today, the couple live in a small apartment in northeast Philadelphia. Following the U.S. invasion of Iraq and more violence, Abdelwahid started receiving threats because of his public profile. In the mail one day, he received an envelope with 2 bullets, one apparently meant for him, another for his wife. They fled to Jordan when a second envelope came and got permission to come to the U.S. in 2009.
Many people say to me, oh, in Pennsylvania, there are many studio, many TV, many newspaper. Oh, that's, I go to work, me. I'm very happy.
But as it turns out, there's no Arabic language TV made here in Philadelphia. Plus, Abdelwahid's health had deteriorated, limiting his options.
I am old man now, but I feel sometimes now I am ready to read a news or to do everything I can. But when I sit, I can work for 5-6 months continue to write or to read or to teach anything.
It's a sense of displacement many retired people can feel. But for some refugees, the move to another country emphasizes this even more. The couple have made a small community of friends, mostly Arabic-speaking refugees, and a few Iraqis, like the men who recognized Abdelwahed at his English class. His wife says that she gets emotional when she makes new friends here.
Myself, I cry. I cry because it's nice to have a friends this way from the same country. Even if we have been in our country, maybe we don't know them. Yeah. But when we are in the other place, we are now friends with them.
In their home, they also have a set of beautiful leather-bound books Abdelwahed wrote about Arabic grammar. After he retired from the news business, he taught young Iraqi broadcasters formal Arabic grammar and how to present themselves on air. And every couple of weeks, Abdelwahed still gets emails from former students in Baghdad with questions about classical Arabic. He writes back and jokes with them that his Arabic is getting rusty now that he's in the United States.
I forgot my language because I am American now. They say, no, you are still our teacher.
He's working on his English. He knows he makes mistakes. But that's okay in his second language. Not for a news announcer, but for a man who lives his life quietly and watches the news from Iraq read on television by someone else. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs, Philadelphia.
You're tuned to The World. I'm Carol Hills. A guest house owner in Aceh, Indonesia, decides to forge her own path and hire more women.
I had a problem working with men because they never listened to what I said. Since I changed with more women, they work hard, they're not lazy.
A businesswoman who's owning it in Indonesia. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We have a series of stories coming up that we're really excited to share with you. We're calling the series Owning It. It's about women and economic empowerment. Next week, our stories will be all about women doing business in Kenya. More on that in a few minutes. First, we go to Aceh, Indonesia. You may remember Aceh as one of the places devastated by a tsunami in 2004. After the disaster, leaders in the Muslim-majority province got something they waited for a long time, the ability to implement Sharia law. They insist their version of Sharia is milder than others across the globe, but one woman is testing the limits. Ruth Morris has our story.
Aceh juts into the Indian Ocean and literally stretches towards the Arab world. It's sometimes called the Terrace of Mecca. But that terrace has a kind of annex, mostly known to diving aficionados. It's the island of Pulau Wei, just a 45-minute ferry ride from the capital of Banda Aceh. The Casa Nemo Resort sits on a hillside of coconut trees and birds of paradise, overlooking an emerald sea. You can get a massage with frangipani-scented oil or eat fish that was just caught.
As you see around, there is people with hijab came here.
Balkis Natashira owns Casa Nemo with her husband, a European irrigation engineer. On their beach, women walk along the surf wearing the traditional head covering known as the hijab. It's required of all Muslim women under Aceh's version of Sharia law. Some local authorities have taken rules about modesty much further. They've passed edicts to ban women from straddling a motorcycle or from dancing. But at Casa Nemo, if women choose, they can skip the hijab and wear a bikini. That's Balki's law. She first studied the Quran with her grandmother, and what women should wear was not their religion's concern.
What my grandma used to say is that Islam is beautiful.
Balki says wearing the hijab should be a personal decision, and she herself chooses not to wear it except when she's praying. Something else she learned studying the Quran, that women are equal. For Balki's, that equality extends to her workforce. Look around to see who's serving your avocado chocolate smoothie. It's a woman.
I had a problem working with men because they never listened to what I said. Since I changed with more women, it's much more easier to work. And they work hard, they're not lazy.
Balkis mostly employs single moms, and she offers free English classes to their children on the weekends. She says before, the women were stigmatized. But now
they can buy a motorbike, they're so proud of themselves, they go home, they can sit down with everybody, you know, and I'm happy to see that.
Rum, one shot, two shot of rum.
Valky's made another good hire. I find him under a string of Chinese lanterns at the bar. For Western travelers like me, finding a bar in Aceh, it's a bit like finding a unicorn, only better.
Where are you guys from? I'm sorry, I'm FJ.
FJ, I'm Kate. I'm from England.
England! Yeah. I like your accent.
Fadri Savri, also known as FJ, is the 21-year-old receptionist. On this beach, in this resort, he's openly gay.
Amazing. Amazing for me.
Men are supposed to be covered to below the knee in Aceh, but FJ is wearing short denim cutoffs. He also insists on wearing a powder blue sash during our interview. FJ was recently crowned as the island's tourism ambassador. Pulau Wei may be under Sharia law, but officials rely on tourism to fuel the local economy. So while alcohol is banned for Muslims in Aceh, authorities often turn a blind eye to things like the rum drinks being passed across the counter or FJ's very distressed denim shorts.
I really love this place because I can be myself. Even the owner also is like, oh, FJ, you just be yourself. I cannot live in Aceh. I just cannot be myself. I need to be like, look like a straight guy, but I cannot.
Working with Aceh's Islamic Sharia agency, the government recently rolled out a new batch of laws, including one that threatens gay men like FJ with public canings if they engage in sex. It's the same punishment for gay women and for people who commit adultery. And then there was the time Sharia police took exception to this reggae band that played at Casanimo's New Year's Eve party.
There is this guys from the Sharia police office come down and say, you should stop the band. All my guests was like, what's going on? We want the music.
Then locals raided the party. It's not the kind of incident you want to see in TripAdvisor reviews. Valkis has also complained about police coming by to check documents of Muslim couples staying here to make sure they're married. But tonight, it's quiet at Casanimo. The crickets come alive. FJ offers me a drink.
Casanova. It should be like a mix from the rum, coconut, and pineapple juice. Amazing drink.
FJ's employer, Valkis, is not sure how much more Sharia law she can take. In the worst-case scenario, she says she'll have to give up on Western tourists and focus exclusively on Muslim guests instead, leaving the resort with a manager.
But I will not live here. I will just move to another place where they respect everyone's decision, everyone's rights. I think our mind is like a little parachute, no? And if you don't open the parachute, you're going to die.
Valkis eats a hamburger and wanders off to mingle with guests. For now, she says, her dream has come true. She opened her mind, and she got Casanimo. For The World, I'm Ruth Morris, Pulau Wei, Aceh.
We have beautiful pictures from Aceh, plus an animation featuring Balki's voice. You can see all that at PRI.org. Next week, our series on women and economic empowerment shifts to Africa. My colleague Marco Werman and a team of producers are in Kenya right now. They've been traveling across the country, meeting some Kenyan businesswomen who are truly owning it out there. Series producer Andrea Crossan joins me now from the Masai Mara National Reserve in southwest Kenya. And Andrea, I'm excited to speak to you because I really want to know what you have in store for us next week.
Hey, Carol. Well, the Cross Women's Lives team has been zigzagging around Kenya for the last week, and we have been meeting some truly astonishing women. As you mentioned, we're in Masai Mara, and I'm going to get to why we are here in just a minute. But first, I want to tell you about a couple stories that are coming your way next week in our series, Owning It. Women don't tend to be farmers here, and we went to an all-women's farm where they're growing aloe. That aloe is going into body products that are sold by Lush Cosmetics. So you could be putting on a little bit of body lotion and having a little bit of Kenyan aloe in it. Another thing that we have coming your way, Nairobi has been called the Silicon Savannah. So we met with some young women who are working in a slum in Nairobi, getting training to become web programmers and web designers.
Sounds great, Andrea. Now, you mentioned you're in this wonderful place right now, the Masai Mara Reserve. Tell me more about who you're talking to there.
I'm going to be talking to Sophie Sadara. Sophie is Maasai, and she is a female guide here. And there's only a handful of female guides, and just women don't do this job. So I'm on the edge of the Maasai Mara Reserve, which probably explains why this isn't the best line ever. But I have to say, this was the most amazing thing ever. We actually saw a cheetah take down an impala, so that was incredible. But I don't want you to hear it all from me. I actually have Sophie with me. So if I can just hand her over for a second, I'd love you to just say hi.
Sure.
Hi, hello.
Hi, Sophie. It's terrific to speak with you. Have you always wanted to be a guide?
Oh, yeah. That has been my dream when I was like a little girl. I find myself sneaking out, follow my younger brothers. We go spend the whole day in the bush. We leave home at around 7:30 or 8, and then we come back in the evening. And then when I grew up, I was thinking, I just want to be close to nature. And I thought being a guide is the right way to do it.
Has it been a difficult job?
Actually, in the beginning, people try to discourage you, try to tell you that this is the man's thing. Do you think you can do it? But I must say that always telling them, yes, I can do it.
Sophie Sadara, a guide at the Maasai Mara National Reserve in Kenya. We'll have a lot more stories next week from Andrea Crossan and the rest of the team in Kenya. Meanwhile, you can see their videos, photos, and more at pri.org/womenslives. As Kenyans know well, tourism can be a huge part of a country's economy. They know that in Nepal, too. Back in the spring, Nepal was hit by a massive earthquake. We all saw photos of temples and houses reduced to rubble. All those images left the impression that all of Nepal had been leveled. And that hit the country's tourism industry hard. A political dispute with neighboring India didn't help. So Nepalese leaders asked a group of journalists to come take a look for themselves. Our friend Alina Simone decided to go.
2 months ago, I was invited on a trip to Nepal, sponsored by the Nepalese government, a tourism industry group, and a British-funded NGO, Samarth. The goal was to show tourists that, despite the earthquake and political protests following the new constitution, Nepal was, quote, open for business. I'd never paid much attention to government travel advisories, but I decided to check what the State Department had to say. In October, it issued a warning for Nepal. Also on the warning list, Iraq and Somalia. We want you to know the risks of traveling to these places and to strongly consider not going to them at all, the State Department site said. Yikes. I began to wonder whether this trip was really such a great idea. And at the airport in Abu Dhabi, I wasn't exactly reassured to learn I'd been bumped from my flight because the plane was taking extra fuel to Kathmandu. Protest at Nepal's border with India had led to a severe shortage. But once I finally got to Kathmandu, life seemed remarkably normal. The earthquake damage was largely cleared away and fenced off. There were, of course, lots of empty spaces where centuries-old temples once stood. And in historic Pathan Durban Square, the sound of reconstruction was everywhere. But I was also surprised to find plenty of temples left standing. Like everyone else, I'd seen the footage of post-earthquake Kathmandu and assumed most of Nepal's heritage sites were gone. And that's exactly the impression tourism officials in Nepal were trying to dial back. As Sunil Sharma of the Nepal Tourism Board told me,
it's not Nepal which has been affected. It is only 14 districts which has been hit hard.
61 other districts suffered minimal or no damage. Samarth also commissioned an independent assessment of two of Nepal's most popular trekking routes, Everest and Annapurna. Trekkers are key to reviving Nepal's tourism industry, but government travel warnings boost the cost of travel insurance, and backpackers need that insurance if they're trekking in remote areas, like our next stop, the town of Jomsom at the foot of the Himalayas. It's far from the epicenter of the earthquake and the political struggles at the Indian border, but still, you won't see many tourists here. Tripul Garung is the owner of Om's Home, where he says bookings are down 50%, and he's not the only one depending on tourism here.
Me, I'm running a hotel, but there are people who grow vegetables. You know, they come sell here in the morning, so we buy the vegetables for our guests.
The story was the same in Pokhara. Minimal earthquake damage, major tourism declines. And in Nepal's second largest city, long lines of cars and mopeds were queuing up for rationed gas. It's easy for a tourist to insulate themselves from the day-to-day realities of life here from within a coach bus, but ethical quandaries are just a question away. As I learned from Krishna Pudel at our next stop, the Barahi Jungle Lodge in the Chitwan Valley. When I asked how the hotel was managing during the fuel crisis, he told me,
"We are very close by border of India. And from India, we are getting, you know, illegally, petrol, diesel, and gas. So that way, you know, we are able to manage somehow."
In preparation for my group's arrival, hotel staff made a 10-hour round trip to the Indian border to buy gas on the black market at 4 to 5 times the price. On the one hand, Nepal really needs tourist dollars. On the other hand, the fuel crisis was hitting hospitals, schools, and internet servers. It felt terrible to be using up their scarce resources to, you know, look at some rhinos. I had to ask Krishna, was it really worth it?
Well, I would say, you know, we are not in loss, but...
Long story short...
For the hospitality business, we have to do it.
By the end of my trip, I was left with deeply mixed feelings. As a tourist, there are undeniable pleasures to be had, trekking in Nepal's mountains, parasailing its skies, and touring its temples. But the political crisis and the growing fuel shortage is a real problem for travelers. 2 weeks after we left, all domestic flights in Nepal were grounded. Of course, it's much more than an inconvenience for the people of Nepal. It's a threat to their health and well-being. So one can only hope the crisis is resolved quickly. No matter how much Nepal insists it's open for business, politics are still blocking the gate. For The World, from Kathmandu, this is Alina Simone.
Before the next break, we have just enough time to share another of our book recommendations. You know, in case you happen to need any gift ideas.
Hello from Mexico City. Monica Campbell here, editor and reporter for Global Nation, all things about immigrant life in the U.S. My book pick is Barefoot Dog Stories by Antonio Ruiz Camacho. It's fiction and stories all tied to a wealthy family in Mexico City and a kidnapping that tears them apart and tosses them across borders. It's dark, but also funny and with characters that break stereotypes. And there are descriptions like this. He calls Mexico City's smoggy air something that, quote, tumbled over the city, old and musty, as if rolling out of a drawer that had been closed a long time. Pick it up for more. Adios.
You can find our other book suggestions on our Facebook page. Head over to facebook.com/PRI the world to check them out. I'm Carol Hills with The World. In the past 10 days, two of the biggest news stories unfolded right here in the U.S. First, the shooting in San Bernardino. Then the reaction from Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, who called for a ban on Muslims entering the country. We asked a couple of U.S.-based foreign journalists to tell us how they see all this. Jesus Esquivel writes for the Mexican weekly Proceso, and Gilles Paris is with the French daily Le Monde. Both are based in Washington. Gilles says he's been trying to explain Trump to his French readers.
When you look at Donald Trump from France, you will find a lot of similarities with the National Front we have in France.
The National Front is a far-right party started by Le Pen, and now his daughter is the head of it.
Exactly. And Marine Le Pen today and Mr. Trump are talking to the same constituency. The people who are considered themselves, to some extent, the losers of the globalization. People who are not very educated, who are struggling with economical difficulties, and who have a big anger against what they call the political or the media elite. And that's also a common ground.
Jesus Esquivel, you write for a Mexican weekly magazine. What aspects of the Donald Trump story are you covering?
Well, first of all, when he launched his campaign, his comments about the Mexicans, not much people know him before his comments. I have to explain to the Mexican readers, who is he?
What about the San Bernardino shootings? How do they figure into your coverage, Jesus?
It was like another day in the U.S. of mass killing, but with the fact that this Muslim couple was involved, it turned to be a very important issue to see how the American public and politicians react to that. Another very important fact, they forgot to cover the whole story. How easy is to buy arms in the U.S.? This is not the first mass killing that happened lately. And the real factor is arms are so easy to buy. And we were expecting that someone will say, well, the terrorists are coming to the U.S. from the Mexican border. And I was expecting Donald Trump to say that. But there is a congresswoman, Marsha Blackburn, Republican from Tennessee, that with any proof, she said days after the killing in San Bernardino that ISIS was training people in Mexico, in the northern border of Mexico. And to my readers and to Mexican citizens or Americans who live in the border, say something like that is just crazy talk. And there is this idea that Mexico is like a lawless country because of the narcotraffickers and the killings in the last few years. But let me tell you something. Narcotraffickers, they are business people, and they know if for some reason some terrorists cross the U.S. border to Mexico, the reaction by the federal government of the United States is going to be to close the border completely. And narcotraffickers, they know it's a bad business for them. So they are keeping an eye open on that. And I'm very sure that there is very, very thin possibility that terrorists could enter the U.S. through the Mexican northern border. It's like saying that Pancho Villa is coming again from Mexico and he's going to conquer the U.S.
Gilles, I know one of the angles you've also been covering are U.S. cities, or at least one U.S. city, where Americans are being radicalized. How did you write about that?
Yes, I went to Minneapolis. It was just after San Bernardino because we know that a lot of people from the Somali community left for Somalia to join the Shabab, Al-Shabab, the militia, and then some of them are leaving for Syria. Six of them were arrested this year trying to board a plane to go to Syria. And Minneapolis is one of the three cities with Boston and Los Angeles where a federal program is launched to defuse this this threat of radicalization. But as we know in France, because we are confronted to the same, very same problem, it's very hard to detect the different stage which lead to radicalization.
Is there a simple way to contrast the two approaches? You mentioned Minneapolis being a couple of cities where the government is really trying to intervene and prevent radicalization, and you said similar things going on in France. Is there clear differences between the approach?
Absolutely not, because I think that everybody is looking for a recipe and there is not one for the time being. And if you look at the profiles of the French guys who went to Syria the last 2 years, they are very different. Some of them are coming from the suburbs. Others are coming from very small cities. Some of them are converted. Some are Muslim from the very beginning. There is not one profile of the guys who will join the ISIS.
What angles of these two stories, Donald Trump and the San Bernardino shootings, do you think U.S. journalists may be missing?
The problem I will mention is the coverage of everything Mr. Trump is saying is so huge, but he's playing with the medias brilliantly.
It's like every time he said something, he's like, there is no laws in the U.S. It's like he has the last word for everything.
Jesus Esquivel writes for the Mexican weekly Proceso. Gilles Paris is with Le Monde. They're both based in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks to you, Karen.
Thanks.
Finally, let's leave politics aside and wrap up the show with the latest from a musician known as Bugat. That's the alter ego of Daniel Russo Garrido. He's from Quebec, but his roots are in Latin America, which explains why he sings in Spanish.
La palabra es mágica cuando la dices. Voz da luz, ideas iluminares. Idiomas en el armario desaparecen. Charla con incas pa' que te cuenten. Mi padre guaraní, ya no lo soy. El mundo gira y tira al cowboy. Directo al corazón del búfalo. Cultura de masa, estúfalo, Nel.
Bugat recently moved to Mexico City to get closer to his Latin roots. This track is the first single from his 2015 release called Neo Reconquista. It's about the disappearance of cultures in this digital age.
Sueño de Londres, de vez en cuando, luego despierto y me pongo de pie.
The The song is called Londres by Bugatt. That's B-O-O-G-A-T, Bugatt. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a great weekend. Y al final, el hombre es animal, se lucha Amazonia y lucha cultural. A diario, se borra el pasado en el desierto, andando retrasado a donde vaya. Espérame, coyote, lo quiero textear y falla la conexión. Soy heredero, linaje largo, un desarrollo humano milenario. Frente a lo nuevo, empaquetado en una era de autodestrucción.
PRI, Public Radio International.